the Buddha, we see the Dharma, we see the Sangha. As we'll see in what we read next, it ain't all easy going here by any means, what Rune Master is doing. She says, I stay all day in a state of suspended animation. This is a new chapter on page 123. I stay all day in a state of suspended animation. Exactly sure what suspended animation means here. Presumably mean very still and somewhere between the vision experiences and not having the vision experiences. You can end up in some very strange states in this process. You do end up in some very strange states. And you just have to patiently meditate through it. The same, no matter what you're doing, patiently meditate through it and keep looking up. It is now evening, and the disciple who is with me, although he did not see what I did, is in the same state as I as a result of asking questions for me. I was very frightened after I chose not to continue to go up this morning, for I started to come back down and was going into darkness. I did not wish to go into darkness. I started coming back up again and have remained suspended between darkness and light during the entire day. This business is never without its risks. I don't know what the darkness is that Rune Master is referring to. I'm not sure she knew at the time. I doubt very much she did, actually. But there can be times when you're kind of like feel like you're hovering on the edge of a great abyss. And the way I view it is that the inherent sense of risk keeps you doing one essential thing, and that is continually asking for help. And it keeps you from getting swollen-headed. Your master's not sitting here thinking, oh, look how far I've got, I'm a saint. She's sitting there thinking, whoa, you know, what's over the edge of this one? So that keeps you keeping your spiritual grounding is really important. How do you do that? Be still. You know, meditate. Be still. Be inwardly still. Draw yourself in. Don't get too far outside yourself. You know, don't get spread out into external things. Be still. Look up. Remember that when the going gets difficult, when you don't know what to do, whether it's difficult or not, you don't know what to do. Stop. Ask for help. Listen. You know, you can always go back, you know, to Rune Master's commentary on the precepts. When I think of her commentary on the precepts, the cautionary notes that come up most often are: do nothing whatsoever in a hurry. Do nothing whatsoever on the spur of the moment. Ask the Lord of the house. You know, look before you leap. Ask before you leap. You know, slow it down. Remember, meditation. Nothing matters. Mindfulness is all. Even in the midst of these exquisite experiences, there's risk. And she's asking questions. She's getting other people to check with her. What is good to do here? Not taking anything for granted. She goes on to say, I am needed to do some work, but both my disciple and I feel very strange. He needs to come back. I must tell him to come back, and this releases him. Or I tell him to come back, and this releases him. I know that I too must somehow come back into myself and stop standing in the column of light. I ask if this is the right thing to do, and I'm told yes through my disciple. I find myself coming back down the fifth column of light and enter by the Buddha mark on my forehead. I come to rest in the center of the flower within my hara. I must not forget the words, go in and out. So I just need to talk a little bit about another one of the real pearls from Rev Master's commentary in the precepts, where she talks about if it is good, if it is right. She said, if it is good, it's beyond good and evil, you know, in the worldly sense, in the ordinary religious sense, for that matter. If it is right, it's beyond right and wrong. Here, the if it is good is really important. You know, although Rim Master doesn't say it at this point, this is a key feature of what she's doing here. The checking, if it is good. You know, is it good to stay out when you need to come back in? Is it good to stay in when you need to go back out? No, it's good to do what genuinely needs to be done, or is genuinely good to do. How do you know what is good to do? How do you know? Well, you have the precepts to help, and the precepts only go so far. The precepts tell you what not to do. They don't tell you an awful lot about what to do. So if you have a choice of what to do, you know, how do you know? You know, ask, listen. What is it that is truly good? What is it that is good to do? Trust your instincts. You know, we're basically brainwashed in our form of education out of really trusting our instincts. And of course, that's only reinforcing the kind of karma that got us reborn, where people didn't trust their instincts, didn't really listen, and got into real trouble. Then despaired or judged themselves as a result of the trouble they got into. We're not them. We aren't ourselves as we were when we were children. Now we're adults. Now we have the opportunity, you know, to hear the teachings of the Buddha and to relearn how to trust our instincts. How to trust the voice of the Lord of the house. How to hear it, how to trust it. Just as I've talked about faith as a kind of knowing without knowing, so hearing the voice of the Lord of the house, trusting your instincts, is usually, you know, your spiritual instinct, is usually a kind of a hearing without hearing. One Zen master described it, I think, brilliantly. It's like groping for your pillow in your sleep. It's a kind of a half-conscious, half-not-conscious. Listening and trusting. The most important thing is that if you've truly asked, and you're making the effort to really meditate, to just bring your meditation into your daily life, then you won't be willfully blinding yourself to that little nudge in the right direction. So actually that's what's going on here. That's what the master's not talking about, but that's the background of everything she's doing here. At this point, you know, the listening, the hearing, they're much more like fully conscious than they are for most of us most of the time. And for Reverend Master most of the time, both before and after this experience. Because everything's, you know, greatly clarified and kind of distilled out in a time like this and in sharper relief. And it's the same basic process. You know, don't wait around for the lightning bolt to strike you. One day in the distant future, you know, one day when I'm enlightened, I'll be able to really hear. Well, it may be that right to this day it's difficult to hear, but it's never actually difficult to ask. And asking is the beginning of hearing. It's like you've got to turn in the right direction, face in the right direction to get the message. What's going on in her coming, going out into that, you know, kind of up that column of light and then back in, is very similar to what's happening at probably the same basic thing that happens at the time of death. You know, you kind of go out at the crown of the head, ideally, it said. So this what's called the spirit body goes out at the crown of the head, the time of death. But if you don't die, you come back in at the forehead, the third eye. And this is... And I'm pretending to understand it, but this is just the way the water of the Spirit circulates. Up through the crown of the head and back and over the top of the head and then back in through the third eye. Not that I personally have experienced it in that detail more than once or twice. But... that's how I understand it happens. Since I come to rest in the center of the flower within my hara, regrounded within the hara. Regrounded within the hara. You know, there isn't, you know, the I that she speaks of here, you know, where it's, you know, it's not the egocentric I again. It's just, you know, if you just kind of take the idea of the I, egocentric I out of it. You know, what is it? Well, it's that's where the center of things is moving. That's where it's being experienced. The center of her identity is being experienced. The focus of her consciousness. She says, I am beginning to have a bad cold and not feeling well. I do not wish to take any more spiritual journeys for a little, but it is obvious that I am going to continue. These are very hard work, what's happening here. You know, when the spiritual journey happens, you know, the body goes into a very, very, as I've talked before, everything draws within you, go into a very, very weak state. And might probably at this time, things are so deep, she probably is hovering right on the edge of death in at least some of these experiences. And it is very exhausting, I'm sure. So part of her is at this point wishing for, you know, it's been very intense for at least a week here. And she's really starting to wish for a little recuperation time. However, in a little normal time. However exquisite the experiences are. And the Eternal's got other ideas. River Master is getting a very, very condensed, very, very intense, deepened education. You remember that her purpose for living that came up so clearly is she wished to continue to live to be a monk. Now she's being shown what it truly is to be a monk in all of its aspects. And this has to happen in a very brief time here, because she has a lot to do. And indeed, there was, you know, I was in the monastery at the time. There was all hell popping loose in the monastery at that time. A lot of us were having really intense karmic stuff coming up. And her master's not talking about what she was doing at this time, but when she wasn't in these spiritual journeys, she was helping. And all the time, whether she was in these spiritual journeys or not, she was grounding us all. Those of us who stayed and stuck it out. As you'll see soon, you know, a lot of people left around this time. She says, "During the night, I am conscious of sitting still in the center of the golden lotus. The doors are open to the world and golden light streams out of them. That which is standing at the center of the golden flower is now the newborn Buddha with one hand pointing up and the other down." It's said that the Buddha, when he was born, took some steps, a very precocious child, and pointed up and with one hand down with the other, I think signifying that heaven and earth were brought together in his or calling heaven and earth to witness or something like that in his birth. And my personal feeling is that's taking certain poetic liberties. And the Buddha himself probably never even occurred to him that that happened when he was a baby. But later people tend to embellish. Hope that doesn't make me a bad Buddhist for thinking like this. But I don't think the supernatural is needed to add to what already happens. Because I think that the miracle of conversion is itself the only real miracle. And the miracle of the eternal's grace is the only real miracle we need. But I could be wrong. She says, "The baby Buddha is standing in the center of the column of light which has entered my head, and this column is in the center of the golden flower. The column and the baby Buddha melt into a diamond nyoi, which is exactly the shape of my spine. It changes into a lotus blossom, then into a lotus pod, then into a bud, into a dragon with five whiskers which curl up and become the five columns of ascending light, and into the elephant with five trunks that curl up into these same five columns. It constantly changes from one to the other." Like I said, when I first saw this, I just felt I couldn't put it in words at the time, but I sometimes felt I was like drowning in all these symbols. This kind of flood of symbols. And Reverend Master herself may have felt like that a bit at the time. You know, this is a lot of stuff coming really fast. A few days ago, I thought of this funny little metaphor that it's kind of like in her whole previous training, especially in the early months of this retreat, she'd been like winding the spring of merit up. She'd been winding the spring of merit up. I get this kind of image in my mind of this really stiff spring. You know, this stiff kind of rod of metal, of spring steel that she is winding or like around this column. You know, it was a great effort. And now in the latter part of the experience, it's like it's going sporing. It's as you come to this point, it's really sproing, you know, fast and powerfully. And all this stuff's just spewing. And these are, remember she said, the Eternal takes us very literally. My purpose is to be a monk. So here are aspects of what it is to truly be a monk being displayed in her experience. Boom, 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 boom. then she understands it. She understands it. She says, I understand that sometimes I am the diamond scepter which penetrates the universe. Sometimes I am the lotus blossom. Sometimes I pour out the seeds of the Dharma. Sometimes I am a new blossom, and at other times a new bud. Sometimes I am the defender of the faith, and sometimes I am holy. And all of these things find their root in the center of the golden lotus within my hara. Sometimes I am this, sometimes that. I am that. What is it that governs what I am now or what I am later? It's the if it is good. Where does the if it is good from come from? From the eternal. Ultimately, when it is, there's a story that I love about the Buddha and his disciples. And some of his disciples came to the Buddha and said, such and such a monk is not shaving his head on the 1st and 15th, you know, when we shave heads. He's not shaving his head. And the Buddha replied, if it is good for such and such a monk, he should shave his head. If it is not good for such and such a monk, he should not shave his head. And the eternal, following the eternal is like that. You know, if it is good to do X, do X. If it is good to do Y, do Y. How do you know? You fall back upon faith, upon asking, upon pure meditation, upon listening, upon waiting, upon offering. Sometimes we're in the position of the newest trainee in the monastery. No matter how far we go, sometimes we are in that position. Sometimes we're in the position of the defender of the faith. Sometimes we're in the position of the wisest person in the monastery. Any of us may be in that position, at any of those positions at any point. So we have to have a kaleidoscopic mind and heart. A heart open in willingness to do whatever is good to do and to change course whenever it is good to change course, to go with the eternal. Not to be rigid, except when it's good to be rigid, which sometimes it is. That's the diamond scepter. Sometimes it's good to be hard as a diamond. I remember this, you know, a point in my training when my doubts and confusions were really coming to their kind of crisis point. In the two or three years leading up to that, now and then I'd kind of bat heads with Reverend Master. Whenever I did, I felt like I'd ran my head into a brick wall. You just got nowhere. And of course I've had some disciples who had that experience with me as well. You just got nowhere. You got nowhere. There's no way you could move her when she set her feet and said no. She's being the diamond scepter then. Sometimes the master has to be as flexible as the most flexible reed. Sometimes the master has to be like a great diamond that the disciple crashes their head into and sits there for the next week kind of rubbing their head wondering what hit them. Just following the eternal. That's really what this is about. This is about following the eternal. In the practical sense of what that fifth column means for us, it means following the eternal. She says, I am very frightened that I cannot bend because of the rigidity of the diamond scepter. The diamond scepter just then becomes my spine, and I am even more frightened that I cannot bend. And the baby Buddha still stands within the golden lotus. As I move, the diamond scepter becomes a lotus, and I am able to bend. The stem is always flexible. system is always flexible when it's good that it be flexible. And if it's good that for a while it be rigid, it becomes very rigid. But it's never rigid forever. She says, I stay thus until the morning. The five columns come out sometimes from the Buddha mark on my forehead and sometimes from the five points of the golden crown or lotus upon my head. At other times they form the column at the base of which is the baby Buddha. I now know the meaning of all five. They truly are the aspects of the monk. The first is earth penetrating heaven. The second, the knot of eternity. The knot of the eternal love of the Lord of the house, which meets our need and washes it and mixes and melds with it in the process of conversion. The third is heaven penetrating earth. The help and the teaching flowing unobstructed to the need. The fourth, the putting on of the golden kesa, which is within the fountain of the Buddha's wisdom, the bathing within its radiance, the water of the spirit, the water of wisdom and compassion flowing to every nook and cranny, and saving every bit of the need. The fifth, the ability to die while sitting and standing, which transcends both peasant and sage. The right to go to heaven or hell if the intention is right, to help all living things. Heaven and hell means something different here than heaven and earth. Hell always means an intense suffering. She puts it in terms of the right to go to heaven and hell. I would put it in terms, and normally I think most often I've heard her put it in terms of the willingness to follow the eternal, wherever the eternal leads you, whether it be to heaven or to hell or anything in between. It's the following of the eternal that is our part of that fifth column. The response of our will to what is offered by that fifth column. It is the following. Even though we didn't know it at the time, what is it that brought us to training? The following. One can follow without even knowing that one is following. She says, my wish for now is just to be a monk that I may take all beings with me to this exquisite place. Shri Buddha, Shri Dharma.